I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Tom Crawford. His new book is called The Names of Birds. It's a book of poems, and he will be reading from the book and signing books on Wednesday of next week, the 18th of January at 5 o'clock at Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be here.
So you are what one might call a birder.
I am a birder.
What's a birder?
Well, they're a funny... Actually, I have a poem that I could read about that describes a birder.
Excellent.
Rather than explicate my poem, I'll just read my poem. Birders, nationally, except for trappists, are quieter than the rest of us, lighter on their feet, too. What's odd is their uncommon excitement at just seeing a bird, rare or ordinary. Arms start waving and legs are inclined to wobble in some kind of gratitude. But if you think of them as species, these birders, they're not so endangered as the monks, but they are on the list of those most likely to become so, owing to their unguarded enthusiasm. Never mind, love them. They might just be our last best hope.
Tom Crawford. So this is a point of view that I don't see very often, because it's people who are not only obsessed with birds, but, I mean, you use them as a way to think about everything else in the world. And as I was reading the book, I felt like through your eyes, I'm seeing the world, I'm seeing bombs falling, human violence, and all of these things from the point of view of nature, from the point of view of birds, who, if they're thinking anything, are thinking, what are these crazy people doing?
Right, right. You know, this really began with my grandsons, Lael and Aiden, 10 and 13, a couple of years ago, when I realized that the world we were handing on to them was so diminished from the one I grew up in and played in. So that's how I got into the business of thinking more in an activist way about what we were losing. And I felt responsible, and I wanted to do something that was original. I'm not an ornithologist. I wasn't interested in birds in that way. I was interested in the human connection to birds in terms of the ways in birds and wild things empower us and make us feel whole and complete. So I was more interested in the mythology, a Joseph Campbell, you might say, approach to understanding the journey and the need for storytelling, which explores myth and a sense of wonder and a sense of potential, human potential. That's a long-winded answer, but it started with my grandsons. But another aspect of it was reading a piece of the New York Times years ago, and it was talking about endangered species, and I began to notice that the language, the scientific language, was so impersonal and unemotional. And I thought to myself at that time, I can do better than this. And I thought also, though I hadn't worked it out in my head yet, because I've been working on this book now for 3 years, that what science can't give us is an emotional measuring of our world. And they can't quantify...
In fact, they strive hard not to
not
do that.
To. And they, so the, since they can't quantify human feelings, they avoid them. And okay, that's all right for their sort of objective way of measuring things. But if you think of conservation and you think of how essential it is if we're going to try to save what's left, then you have to be a storyteller. It's only art that can do that. Science can't do that. So that was another motive. I wanted to write a book which really move people in this way I've described. And nothing does that better than poetry. So.
Yeah, and again, you know, you have all these feelings when reading the book, and part of the feeling that I had was the poem as protest.
Yeah.
And then you think about the poem as protest, and then you think about the number of people. On the one side, the amount of craft and love that goes into each poem and in each line. And on the other side, the number of people who actually read poetry.
Yeah, you're bringing up the ancient struggle. Years ago, someone shared with me the idea that the problem we have, particularly have in America, is it's an ancient struggle between the mystic and the rationalist. The rationalist, i.e. the scientist, resents the mystic, i.e. the poet, because the poet or artist derived their power from irrational source. That makes the rationalist very uncomfortable. And you can't quantify it, makes him doubly uncomfortable. And we have that dichotomy in our culture, and that's why poetry suffers for an audience. When I lived in China and I lived in Korea, that wasn't true.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary. You could go into a bookstore in South Korea. What would be in the front of the store when you walked in? Poetry. The tradition there is Confucian, and poetry is like the top of the pyramid in terms of achievement with language.
And everybody respects their poets.
Yeah, and expect it. You think, oh, my God. In China, if you're a poet, it's like, oh, my God, that's wonderful.
Somebody was telling me that about Nicaragua also, that it's
absolutely
a country of poets.
Same thing.
Yeah.
I remember reading once about Nicanor Parra, a South American poet, and he was a teacher at a university, and someone said, well, you know, the poets, when they have a poet, they provide a special parking place for his car or her car. So they don't have to struggle to big university. I thought, isn't that cool?
And here poets are lucky if they have a car.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We're talking to Tom Crawford about his new book, The Names of Birds. I was thinking about, I guess the title brings up a question for me, which is, what is gained from naming birds?
You mean literally the name?
Like what kind, not calling it Joey, but the kind of bird that it is. I mean, that's a blue-tailed...
That's an interesting question. It actually goes to the idea of naming, period, because art is about naming. Whether you're a painter or a novelist or a poet, you're actually naming things, and that's what brings them alive. So when you have a bird like a, curved-bill thrasher, it's a wonderful word to say, or series of words. Starling, it's a beautiful word. And it goes on like that. And I think with poets in particular, the lyricism is what they're after. It becomes part of the music of the poem. And you sort of find yourself wanting to incorporate that sound into these other sounds which are all, make up the poem, the lyrical poem particularly. So, can I read a poem?
Yes.
And I'll do this. It's called All the Birds Are Here. It's a noisy gathering to wave us goodbye. No hard feelings. Just one reason, like dogs, I so like birds. They don't hold a grudge. What a fine thing to let go almost immediately all the bad things we've done to them. You can see the bomb falling. It's packed with all our good intentions. The white-rumped warbler makes me smile. If you want to get in here, you can add your bird now. It's a damn shame, isn't it, how our tool-making just got out of hand? A word that kills, reclamation. A word to love, water bird. Any bird can fly rings around a rocket, and Mars is no wetland. The contemplative bittern lives down deep in the reeds. Its single "awk" when forced to fly, leave me alone. This is our trail of tears, but not our Oklahoma. Everything's used up we might have called home.
There are dimensions in this book the names of birds to me about quiet, about song, bird song. But it seems that, I mean, a lot of people talk about getting quiet through meditation, and it seems like being quiet enough to see birds, and a lot of it is out your window at the bird feeder.
That's
it's not
right.
like you're going on big treks into the...
Absolutely, absolutely. Most of the wonder is your backyard, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it requires and cultivates in you, the poet, and I guess anybody who might have I have a bird feeder, but a kind of quiet that changes you, and you start listening and seeing differently.
That's a nice observation, actually, what you're saying. And it is, bird watching is contemplative by nature. We don't go around thinking we're monks or that we've joined some, you know, order. But the truth is, birds slow you down. If you, and once you start doing that, they in a way sort of come inside, and you find you've developed a need to watch them. And part of what it is, what you're saying, the quiet is itself empowering, it's nurturing. And it's an egoless enterprise. And I think that's comforting to us. We get outside ourselves, and what's paradoxical, you went inside to get away from your ego. Because you're going outside because you're observing something out here in the world that's magical. And you never ultimately can explain it, and that's part of what poetry and art is about. We just identify it and then live the feelings. We live the feelings. If you're a poet, you write.
Well, there's this thing. I mean, we scientists name things white-rumped warblers, and poets talk about things in a way that is poetic and loving, and the more words you have. But I was thinking, birds recognize each other.
Absolutely.
And birds and animals all recognize each other, and they don't have, as far as we know, well, some of them do. I mean, we've talked about prairie dogs actually have words for things, and maybe birds are saying to each other, look out for the coyote on the other side of the fence. Who
That's
knows?
Right.
But
right.
there is a dimension, even as you are a poet writing about things and naming them, there's a feeling of the nonverbal and letting yourself be nonverbal for long periods of time, which maybe changes the way you write.
What you're asking, or what your observations are, it's are wonderful, and they're about trying to corral really the mystery, because on one level it is about language and it is intellectual and you are making connections. But on this other, more essential level, it's emotional and it's intuitive. And you're bringing all these forces together. And then out of that, a poem will begin to emerge. And then it begins to have a life of its own, and you sort of follow it to see what the poem wants to say. Let me give you an example. William Stafford, to his students one time, said, it seems to me that you want a map to the wilderness. And he said, if you're going to be a poet, there is no map. So there's no, that's the discursive world. That's the world of, I can explain this. No, you can't explain this. You can't explain art. You can only create it and love it. But the contemplative aspect for the writer is always there. You have to be alone. You know, you have to set that time aside. And you have to be open to the magic possibility. There's a poem at the end of this book which kind of explores that. And I put it at the end of the book. It's about Bosque della Pace.
Yeah, I saw that one.
And this is an example of where people, they're not talking. And it's in the half light, almost dark. And they're in cars, and they're standing along the water. And they're watching the cranes. Here's the poem, Bosque della Pace. Birders are like old monks from another life, still in formation, still shy. They can't seem to break the habit of silence, to rise early, to hope. They gather in the cold by a lake and then just stand there quietly and stare out into the darkness. They love what can't be improved on. First flight, first light, bird song, the perfect hydraulics of the crane's legs that fold back in a shower of water as their great wings lift them all into the morning sky. Among these curious, no reckless enthusiasm. It's not a football game. The older ones too frail for the cold watch from their cars until the birds are out of sight. That's it. The lake water still trembling, but empty. One or two might have taken pictures, their only show of attachment.
Tom Crawford from his book of poems, The Names of Birds. There's a sense in this book of, I don't want to call it quite hopelessness, but the tremendous gulf between the destruction that we're wreaking and the awareness that you have and that many of us have of that destruction. There's this one poem called Where the Country Goes Wrong, and there's a line in it that says, why won't they run the true story just once, that there's a proven correlation between bird watching and peaceful coexistence?
Yeah, I like that line myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Let me give you, I was sharing this with Jim over at the other table. Let's call it melancholy, for want of a better way of describing some of the tone in the book. Right now, there's this big fight with the Keystone Pipeline.
Indeed.
And I'm so aware of how skewed the news is. Both sides, one wants the petroleum and the money, and the other side wants Obama to move toward environmental direction with the country. But what they don't tell you, and this is what breaks my heart, they don't talk about the tar sands in Alberta where this crude oil is being processed. They don't tell you about the destruction of the boreal forests that it takes to produce the tar sands.
You've got a great poem about that.
Yeah, I do. And then they don't tell you about the 65 square miles of toxic waste dumps that have already been created by those tar sands. And my problem with that is Americans are partly responsible for that because they're buying into the discourse, which is so limited. They don't realize the thousands of songbirds and migratory birds that die every year in those ponds or the environmental impact on their nesting grounds.
Do you want to read the poem?
So the poem is entitled Christopher Columbus Discovers the Tar Sands of Alberta. I have to say, when this poem was shared with a large audience of news people up in Missoula that came from all over the world, David Duncan, who wrote the introduction to this book, read this poem to them, and it really knocked people over the accuracy of it. The poem goes, how did it happen? He got so far inside us. You shave and you shave, and he still grows back as wilderness caved in under the iron shoes of his horses. The rumble we hear now, the coming of giant modules on flatbeds down our roads, assaulting our towns, our families. They're not in the stars, dear reader, but in ourselves. And what's this new plan? 500 years later, once they crawl their way to Alberta on these mammoths, we're going to build a fire, then we're going to cook the earth sick till it pukes up its oil. And if we have to, that's right, you're in the kitchen on this one, America. I mean, if we have to, we'll deep fry 160 million wildfowl and songbirds in summer nurseries and nesting grounds. How to save what's left? Hard work. You'll have to pull the Columbus in you out from behind the wheel, America. All good poems are hard work. they say, change your life, change your life.
There we have it, ladies and gentlemen. Tom Crawford. The question of where art comes from really came to my mind while reading these poems, because it became so clear that art, like everything else, comes from nature. We come from nature, poetry comes from nature, and even those of us living in cities and our life is asphalt, it's still what's underneath everything, and it comes out very strongly, I think, in your work.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm a country boy, and I think in some way, Robert Frost said a wonderful thing. He said that he was more country than city, and I've sort of always, that always resonated for me. I've lived in many cities, but I was raised in the country. And on a farm, actually, so my connection with domestic animals and wild animals and trees and plants was quite rich. But I think you're absolutely right that connection is real, whether you live in New York or you live in Missoula, Montana. The problem, the struggle we have, is that increasingly, the urban world smothers out our sense of the connection with wild things and the natural world. And that's at our peril.
Yeah.
Because if we lose it, we've essentially lost the very thing that sustains our own lives. That's why birds are a marker. One of the most compelling and terrifying statistics is this. In the 1500s, birds went extinct at the rate of 1 every 100 years. Today, they go extinct at the rate of 1 every year. And that's a clear marker to our own inevitable distinction.
Yeah.
Extinction.
Well, and if that's a clear marker to our own inevitable extinction, the species that do survive will probably, and you say this in one of your poems, have a marvelous time without us there.
Absolutely. I think they will. Some guy... there was a film not so long ago about what will happen to the earth when we're not here, and he shows about cities falling apart, but that wildlife comes back abundantly.
Yeah, exactly. The World Without Us. It was a wonderful book by a terrific journalist.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, The World Without Us.
Yeah.
It scared the hell out of me, but I read it.
Well, and one of the things, I guess, that I was thinking about in the ways in which human beings come from nature but have distorted it in so many ways is violence. I mean, there is violence in nature. All these birds are eating other creatures, and other creatures are eating and being eaten by it. I mean, it's a world of predator and prey, and yet the way that humans have taken it to a level of madness that departs from the kind of violence that you have in nature, that also was a train of thought that was stimulated by your poems for me.
Yeah, we perpetrate such violence on nature, which includes other human beings. But
out of something other than the need to eat today.
Yeah, and that's a real enigma. I don't pretend to understand. I don't think anybody else does. Why we can't live in some kind of harmony in the world and respect each other, regardless of our culture or our language. When I lived in China and South Korea, I lived there for 8 years. And in China, I used to love to go down and watch the Chinese gentlemen with their birds in cages. And it was sort of like, we call it walking your bird. They never let the bird out of the cage, but all the men, it seemed to be a male thing, they'd carry their bird down in a bird cage that they had designed themselves, and all the men sit around, smoke, and look at each other's birds. And
amazing.
Yeah, and you see this kind of thing in other cultures.
And people say, oh, we're all the same the world over, but when you look at cultural differences like that, it's just extraordinary.
No, it's about tradition, and that kind of behavior comes out of rich tradition. I mean, you could say other things about Asian people generally in terms of their eating habits, but It's all... There's always a downside when human beings are involved. I don't think there's a downside when birds are involved. I think you're right. I have a poem in here about a hawk will eat one bird.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, and I don't know where that poem is. Is that right up front? I think it is. Yeah, it is. It's called "It's Such a Relief to Want Less," and I think that's...
Why did you read it?
Yeah, and I think that goes to the heart of what we're talking about here. It's such a relief to want less. Let the sharp-shinned hawk, who is not greedy, so eats only one small sparrow a day, be my model. Right down to the wing-picked joints and the tidy pile of gray feathers, the wind soon blows away. Nobody in my family learned the quiet habit of bird watching. We weren't in one place long enough for a feeder, for the songs our own silence might bring. Age comes swift, but my eyesight only gets better. No tragedy in my backyard, no props, no villains. There's no such a thing, you know, as a sick old hawk.
Tom Crawford's book of poetry is called The Names of Birds. He will be speaking on Wednesday, January 18th at Garcia Street Books at 5 in the afternoon. The book is published by Sherman Asher Publishing right here in Santa Fe. They're on the web at shermanasher.com. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be here. Nice to share.